the hat is probably the thing that makes people feel the most uncomfortable. What do you mean? What do you mean he has a hat? Is it like a magic hat?
Is he not looking at the plates? I think most people picture him looking at the plates.
Right.
Whereas it's pretty clear most of the time he's not. I think 90% of the time, Joseph would not be able to point and say, this is what I am translating from. Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about elements of the Scriptures that make them more real to us so we can draw more power out of them because we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Carrie Muehlstein, and I'm so happy to have with me very special guest. We have Garrett Dirkmont with us today. Thanks for being here, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
And Garrett hosts his own podcast. We'll ask him to tell you a little bit about that in just a minute. But first of all, let me just give you the briefest introduction of you, Garrett. Garrett, I love Garrett. He is so much fun and has the best stories ever. He teaches in our college in the Department of Church History and Doctrine, but came to us from the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And currently, they've partially stolen him back.
Yeah, I'm working on a project with the Church History Department now.
Yeah. Yep. So I think you're still technically part of us.
I'm still a BYU employee.
Yeah,
but I don't want anyone to think I'm not.
Yeah, and I think they learned their lesson with that because like when they pulled Steve away and he had to go through the rehiring process, that was just a tricky process. Yeah. So they're not doing that to you. So you're glad he can pave the way for us.
I am grateful to be employed doing both things.
Yeah. So tell us more about yourself. What should we know? What do you do? Tell us about your podcast.
Okay. Well, so my PhD is in American history. I got my PhD at the University of Colorado. I studied 19th century American foreign relations and primarily Latter-day Saint relations with the federal government at the time of Joseph Smith and then the expulsion in early Utah. And right as I finished my PhD, I was hired by the Church History Department and the Joseph Smith Papers Project to work on those volumes. And so I was the historian and editor among a team of people for several volumes there. And then after about 4.5 years, I got hired at BYU in the Church History and Doctrine Department, which is awesome. That's where I always wanted to be. And I continued to work on the papers. Actually, while I was there, so it was not as big a sacrifice as it could have been because I was still working on them, even though I was now teaching, which is what I wanted to do.
Yeah, you're doing both things.
I was doing everything. Yeah, it was an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
And so the first Joseph Smith Papers volume that I worked on was actually Documents Volume 1, the first Documents volume. The Joseph Smith Papers are broken up into different kinds of documents, like many documents volume, many papers projects are. And so there's journals volumes that are all of Joseph's journals. There's, Revelation volumes that are the revelation books that where they collected the various, handwritten revelations in them. But most of the project was the documents. So most of it is, every letter that Joseph ever wrote or received. Because you get information from that too. I mean, you might have someone write a letter to Joseph Smith and say, in the letter you sent me on the 14th, well, we don't know what that letter was. So we don't have a copy of the letter Joseph sent, but through context, we can get a little bit of an understanding, like he must've been asking Orson Pratt about this because that's how Pratt's responding to him. So every letter he ever wrote or received, every sermon he ever gave that was recorded, every minute of every meeting he was in, every revelation, published and unpublished. So, many people think that every Joseph Smith revelation is published there in the Doctrine and Covenants, but there's actually many revelations that Joseph received that are treated as revelations, that are acted upon as revelations, that were never published in the Doctrine and Covenants. And so that first documents volume covered the earliest period for which we have documents, basically 1827 to 1831. And of course, a major part of that is the translation of the Book of Mormon, the receipt of these early revelations. And so another colleague of mine and ours, Michael McKay, and I, through the research we did for that volume, we have written several books on the two books on the translation of the Book of Mormon and several articles. The podcast I do, it's called Standard of Truth. Me and my best friend, Richard LaDuke, we...
I thought I was your best friend. You mean your other best
friend? In mixed company, my kind of sort of okay friend. And we answer church history questions. We cover church history topics. People email in and we try to find the original earliest sources for where something comes from. Like, oh, I heard that Joseph Smith said this. Well, why have you heard that? Well, because this person said that, you know, and you go down the line. So that's that. I mean, we like to have a lot of fun and you know, at the same time, I think the way we like to describe ourselves is we take the gospel very seriously. We just don't take ourselves very seriously. So that's probably a good definition of myself as well. So.
Yeah. Everything. So, I mean, our offices used to be right by each other. We were on like co-chairs of committees for a long time. Everything you do with Garrett, you do fun. That's
the way to live life.
Yeah. It's good. I love it. So, well, wonderful. What we want to talk today is about the translation of the Book of Mormon. It's fun to do this after having just finished studying the Book of Mormon and Come Follow Me. I think we all feel so passionate about the power of that book and what we've drawn from it. There are some questions people have about the translation of the Book of Mormon. I've personally spent a lot of time going through that timeline and looking at accounts, but you've spent even more time with that. I also have some things, maybe if we have time towards the end, I'll bring up about looking at the kind of the syntax and linguistic elements of the different, like the printer's manuscript and the original manuscript stuff. So that may be able to cast some light on it. But why don't we just start out by talking about what do we know about the translation process and in particular about the use of various kinds of seer stones?
Yeah. I think that's part of the difficulty for people to wrap their head around the translation is the fact that there's just so many different elements of it and different sources talking about it.
Yeah.
And
none of them are Joseph Smith frustrated.
Yeah. At least not directly.
Yeah.
You certainly have people that are, you know, appear to be sharing what Joseph Smith shared with them.
Right.
But yeah, you don't have Joseph Smith, you know, it's not the 14th article of faith that he's like, and this is how the Book of Mormon was translated. So you don't have that. In fact, you know, there's at least some apparent reticence on Joseph's part to provide details about the translation because Hiram in one early church meeting says, you know, we've got all these new elders here. We should probably tell them how the Book of Mormon was translated. And Joseph says, well, it's not intended to tell the world all the particulars of translation. Yeah. So,
And by the way, he has that same reticence about the translation of the Book of Abraham.
He doesn't really tell people about that.
Really, all of our sources are from scribes, not from Joseph.
Yeah, from people observing it, people participating in it. Some things you almost have to say, well, you know, Joseph must have said this in order for someone to even know that part.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't have these direct sources. And I think for Latter-day Saints, the Book of Mormon is such a central part of their faith that it has always been one of the main points of attack from antagonists who are trying to undermine our faith. And so these early antagonists, and this is going to come as a huge surprise to every Latter-day Saint today, they would mock and make fun of the Book of Mormon and how it was translated and how Joseph received his revelation. So they would take something that was sacred to the people at the time and they would, you know, put it in a laughable light. They would mock it. They would make fun of it. I know it's hard to believe in today's day and age with, you know, the Book of Mormon musical that someone would mock something sacred to a faith group, but that's very much the case in the early days of the church. And so part of what you have going on for your average Latter-day Saint is you have a topic like the translation of the Book of Mormon that, you know, frankly, at least for me, I never had a Sunday school teacher or a seminary teacher or an institute teacher sit down and say, today's lesson is the mechanics of the translation of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Let me show you how it happened.
Yeah.
And so in the absence of a direct lesson of what do we know about it, it's very natural to make assumptions. I mean, assumptions are, they're normal. And so, you know, I studied German in high school and in college. And, you know, the way that I translated was I had a document that was in German and I pulled up my German to English dictionary and I'm like, Fernseher, what in the, oh, it's television. Yeah. And then you, and that's how you kind of envision translation because that's our only experience. And,
right.
And so some of what people think about the translation of the Book of Mormon comes often more from their impression of images that they've seen.
Yeah.
Their impression of how they think it would have worked rather than what our sources say. And because some of what our earliest sources say are the types of things that were mocked by people like Eber Howe, who wrote Mormonism Unveiled, the first anti-Mormon book, it can make people feel uncomfortable. Yeah. So I think it's a difficult topic. I mean, I would say, look, the most important part of the translation of the Book of Mormon is that people realize that it's a miracle, that the most important part is this is a miracle from God.
And that's the one key bit we get from Joseph Smith.
Right.
Translated by the gift and power of God. That's the key thing. He gave us what we needed.
Yeah, he will say, you know, when he's making a public statement on what it is, when he's publishing something like, you know, the Wentworth letter that he knows is going to be, that's supposed to go to the world.
Yeah.
He said, you know, I would inform you that through the medium of the Urim and Thummim, I translated the Book of Mormon by the gift and power of God. So he certainly includes the fact that there are devices involved. Yeah. In fact, when Joseph Smith revises Doctrine and Covenants section 5, one of the revisions he makes is he goes back into it and he places the words translated by the, you know, through the means of the Urim and Thummim into the revelation, rather, even though the original didn't have those words, almost as a way of trying to help, I think, people understand that there are two aspects to translation. There is the seer himself, the prophet, the person who's given the power of God to do it, and these devices that God has prepared for the purpose of translation. So I think one of the things that's helpful to do when you're talking about the translation is what could we know about the translation if all we were looking at was the scriptures? If we start with what should my assumptions be if I go through the Book of Mormon wondering how would these plates get translated? And I think the first place to start is Joseph Smith history, where Moroni tells him, you know, God has a work for you to do and your name's going to be had for good and evil. Well, that part's all come to true for sure. But he tells him that God had prepared stones for the purpose of translating the book.
Yeah. And I think in Joseph Smith history, it says like set in a silver bow.
Yeah, set in a silver bow. Yeah.
Which with the breastplates
and these two constitute, what is called seers in ancient or former times.
Yeah.
And the possession and use of those stones, right? So if all we had was Joseph Smith history, and we read that, we should anticipate that any explanation of how Joseph translated the Book of Mormon that doesn't involve sacred stones, whatever image we see, whatever conversation someone has, it probably isn't completely accurate if it doesn't show Joseph using stones to translate.
Yeah.
So even if in my mind I've envisioned, you know, Joseph, you know, just kind of poring over the gold plates with his fingers on them and that character in Reformed Egyptian must mean this and reading that off to Oliver Cowdery. Even if I've envisioned that in my mind, well, that's not how the angel said that God prepared the translation.
Right.
The angel said God prepared sacred stones for the translation.
And I think that, just that one line in Joseph Smith history, if we'll spend just a second on it, it should prepare us for some things because, so he talks about, he uses the phrase Urim and Thummim there and talks about the ability to translate, but he also talks about those stones. And as you said, using them constitutes a seer. Mm-hmm. And so seer and stones automatically go together according to Moroni, right? There is something about being a seer and using these stones. So we can call it a seer stone. Mm-hmm. And that was a name that goes around in Joseph Smith's day. But that Moroni is telling him from the beginning that seers and stones are going to be used in this process.
Yeah. And you know, the reference that it was in ancient and, you know, times as well as today. So, mm-hmm. It's clear that these sacred stones are used, or other sacred stones, some stones are used by prophets of God more than just with Joseph Smith in the translation.
Oh yeah.
And that's the next place you could go is, so now I've read Joseph Smith history, I should expect that stones are used in the translation. You can then go to the various places in the Book of Mormon that talk about both stones and translation, like ether. Mm-hmm. If you go to ether, the Lord specifically says that these stones that he's prepared for the translation of languages. You have this very interesting exchange in Mosiah between Limhi and Ammon. I mean, not I chop everyone's arms off Ammon, the other Ammon,
yeah,
who,
yeah,
you know, chopped off fewer arms. But
Ammon descended of Zarahemla,
yes,
who goes down to rescue Limhi.
Yes, yeah. And you know, Limhi's people have tried to find Zarahemla. They've sent people out. I mean, it must have been terribly depressing when they found the ruins of the Jaredite civilization and thought, well, this must have been Zarahemla. You know, everyone's destroyed but us, and we're in bondage to the Lamanites. But they find those gold Jaredite plates and they bring them back. And so once Limhi realizes that Ammon is not one of wicked King Noah's priests, that he is not one of the people that's caused all these problems, but he's actually from Zarahemla, one of the first questions he asks him is, knowest thou of anyone who can translate?
Yeah.
And then tells him, you know, we found these plates. I think this would be of great worth to my people. And Ammon's response is, oh, I can most assuredly tell thee, O king, of a man who can translate ancient records, for he has wherewith he can look and translate records which are of ancient date, and it is a gift from God. And then they go into that whole soliloquy of how a seer is greater than a prophet, right?
Yeah. So again, he's associating being a seer with having those stones.
With a stone, yeah. And that kind of begs the question of, you know, what stone is King Mosiah using, or yeah, stones? Because if ether buried the, you know, or hid the two stones he had with the Jaredite plates, then you'd kind of think, well, I don't know how Mosiah would have those yet, or
yeah,
maybe there's some missing jaunt in the Book of Mormon, we don't know. But regardless, Mosiah has stones,
yeah,
that he uses, interpreters, the Book of Mormon generally calls them, to translate. And we get the account later in Mosiah of his translation of those things, so using those stones. But I do think it's important to notice that aspect. He has wherewith he can look and translate records which are of ancient date. So, you know, you could conceive of, well, as long as I'm holding the stone, as long as I have it in my pocket, now I can translate. But it seems to be that the seer interacts with the stone.
Yeah.
He's looking at it or through it, or in some way, these sacred stones help him in translation.
Especially where it talks about setting them almost like spectacles and things like that, right? That kind of suggests that as well.
The earliest way that Joseph describes the stones is he calls them spectacles. That's yeah, that's his earliest account of them. In fact, in his 1832 history, he says, God had prepared spectacles for to read the book, wherefore I commenced translating. And so we see in some of Joseph's early statements, he's using that term spectacles. Now, he doesn't appear to use them that way. And we also have other accounts that perhaps they were so big that you would
yeah,
be pretty hard to do it that way.
Yeah, that was just awkward.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Lucy Maxsmith also describes them as, you know, being large, and I think they resemble spectacles
yeah,
in
yeah,
that regard. So
yeah, I don't think he could put them on it. It seems like they were
it seems like
large
they're too big. Yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't know if maybe maybe, you know, Mormon had a much larger, you know, head or something, and it fit just right. I don't know. But so what you already have from just the Book of Mormon text is that there are sacred stones. God says that he prepares them for the translation of languages. In Mosiah, you learn that God has these seers or prophets look at or through these stones in order to translate ancient languages. And then you get from Alma chapter 37 a discussion of another translation device. And I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce Gazlum or Gazelle. Yeah. I've heard it many ways. I don't speak Nephite, so I have no idea. It talks about how that there is a separate stone that I will prepare unto my servant Gazlum a stone. So rather than the two stones that are bound together, now we're hearing a single stone.
Yeah.
So if all you
and the stone is either called Gazlum, whatever, or the servant is called Gazlum, and he gets a stone. The
either way, there's only one stone.
Right. But the grammar's not precise. There,
well, so, the comma that's added there is added by John Gilbert, the non-Latter-day Saint typesetter of the original Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's led some people to say, well, maybe the reference there is actually that Gazlum is Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Which the earliest Doctrine and Covenants, they published their names with code names. And one of Joseph Smith's code names is Gazlum. So, I mean, it's not a completely off the wall assumption. Right. And,
but either way, whoever is doing this is going to have a stone.
Is going to have a stone, a single stone, rather than the device of two stones bound together that's discussed in ether, right? As an aside, and maybe interesting for your listeners, when W.W. Phelps gives Joseph Smith's funeral oration, he at least says, and I literally have no idea where he would have gotten this information.
Which is true of a lot of things I hear from
almost everything I mean, it's funny. In Utah, Brigham Young a couple of times would get up after Phelps in meetings and kind of chastise him for, like, to hear Judge Phelps tell it he was the most important person in the entire restoration. So there seems to be at times a willingness to exaggerate a little bit on Phelps's part. But at least in that funeral oration, he says that Gazlum is Joseph Smith's pre-earth life name. Now, that's not doctrine. I have no idea.
And he says stuff about all sorts of words that he doesn't know anything about.
He does. I think those are evidences someone might give to say, well, maybe the reference is to Joseph, the seer. But even if the reference to Gazlum is not to the stone, it's to the seer, well, it's still only a single stone.
Right. I mean, the person's a seer because he's using that
because
single
he has
stone.
That stone. Yeah. And I think it's important to note that at least Wilford Woodruff, he believes that that's the name of a single stone. He will say that the seer stone known as Gazlum or Gazlum was shown to the prophet underground. And so he's making a reference to that single separate stone as being this one prophesied of. And that's important. So, you know, people are listening like, well, wait a minute, what do you mean Joseph had other stones? Well, early prophets, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff, John Taylor, they know that Joseph had multiple seer stones. And we generally tend to only think of the stones that Joseph had that he got out of the box with the plates. And that makes sense. I mean, look, my whole life, I assumed that, well, you know, there's two stones in the box, and I guess this one's probably named Urim, and this one's probably named Thummim, and that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so that's why he has those stones. But Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff explain that Joseph has other stones. We don't know when he got his earliest stone because there are differing accounts of when that would have happened.
Yeah.
But nearly all of them fall sometime after the first vision and sometime before the angel Moroni appearing to him. So sometime in that time period between 1820 and 1823, Joseph is digging a well. And
for the Roberts family?
Well, for the...
Sally's family, but no, I can't think of her.
It's the Chases.
Chase, that's yes. It. Yeah, yeah. That's where Sally I got Roberts. Chase. I'm thinking of Chase Roberts, the receiver. Yeah. Okay,
well, you know what?
Yeah.
He's a lot better at catching things than the Chase family is in early church history. So Joseph is his family's very poor. And so on top of working on his own family's land, he and Hiram and Alvin, at least until Alvin passes away, they hire themselves out as day laborers.
Yeah.
And
a lot.
As much as they possibly can. Yeah. I mean, our early records that we have from, you know, some financial transactions with the Smith family shows Joseph, you know, building fences, bucking hay, you know, their labor is one of the only commodities they really have because they're so poor. And in the process of digging this well, Joseph finds this stone. Now, Brigham Young and Wilford Woodruff both talk about this. Mm-hmm. Wilford Woodruff, for his part, believes that Joseph actually knew that the stone was there. And that's why he said, we're going to dig the well here, because he'd already been shown that it was there. At any rate, while he's digging that well, they find a stone. And that is this earliest stone that Joseph has. Now, of course, he doesn't know anything about it. He doesn't know how to use it. He doesn't know that the angel Moroni is going to come appear to him and say, hey, you're about to translate ancient records.
But seer stones are not an unheard of thing in his culture. And even some of his neighbors claim to have seer stones.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's not like it's an unheard of thing. It's just unheard of that it would be used to translate the Book of Mormon, right?
Yeah, more commonly, they're going to make reference to the stones as peep stones, the people in his neighborhood. And boy, trying to wade into 19th century science is, you know, if there's any scientists listening, you're going to have to take a big sigh first, because what they understand of both science and medicine is so... It's so far below where our understanding is now that some of the things that they take as scientific, you would just think is completely ridiculous. You know, I mean, none of us think that the reason why you are sick is you have too much blood in your body and you need to therefore be bled out.
Yeah.
No, none of us think that anymore, but that was what, you know, the Harvard and Yale University medical doctors believe, right? So these early cultures believed that people had abilities that were a part of who they were that allowed them to do things that wouldn't otherwise be explained. A great example of this is using scrying rods dowsing to find water. Right, so you cut down the branch of a green tree and that's forked, and you hold those forks, and it will, you know, they would say that there would be slight pulsations in the branch because the water in the branch would be electromagnetically pulled to the water in the ground. But there are people, farmers today, I know, that will still say, you can find water by doing.
I know great members of the church who have shown me, I've seen them find water.
And they found it that way.
They did. And
there's no real scientific way to explain it.
But it seems to happen.
But it seems to work.
Yeah.
So people think that there are people who happen to have that same ability to see things with certain stones. Mm-hmm. I mean, the best thing you could probably make it equivalent to today is there are somewhere around 25% of Americans believe that in clairvoyance, that there are people who can know of things that they haven't actually seen, that they can know it through their mind. Now, I realize most people don't believe that, but most people don't believe that because of science and things. Yeah. And so in Joseph's day, it would not have been a very weird thing. And in fact, had Joseph come out of that well and showed that stone to anybody and said, hey, there's something weird. I found this stone. There's something weird about it. Yeah. Every person he talked to basically would have said, oh, you know what? You might be one of those people who can see things in stones. Yeah. And so you would have had people almost telling him what that was.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I'll go a little bit on a flip side of this here, because I agree with everything you're saying there. But I will say that there's the backside of, or the flip side of our scientific mindset is that I think sometimes we disallow God to work miracles in our lives because we say that's not how it works. Yeah. And so I'm not saying that everyone that had a peepstone was inspired, and maybe some people were inspired by the wrong source or something along those lines. I don't know. But it's also quite likely that when people were expecting God to speak to them through certain things, that God could speak to them through those things because they believed, they asked, and they received. And we don't believe, so we don't ask, so we don't receive.
Yeah, and God speaks to people according to their own language.
Yep. And their own understanding.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are a lot of, I mean, we certainly know from early church history that the devil can use stones as a means of deceit from Doctrine and Covenants section 28. But I think it's important that, you know, for our purposes in this discussion then to say it's well documented by sources that are not just antagonists. Okay. This is not just anti-Mormons that are publishing books attacking Joseph, claiming that he has stones that he's using in the translation. Wilford Woodruff, who's a pretty pro Latter-day Saint guy, is the one saying, in fact, when he dedicates the Manti Temple, he actually takes a seer stone. I don't know if it's the exact same stone, but he says that I dedicated on the altar, in his journal, he says, I dedicated on the altar the seer stone that Joseph Smith found underground. And I don't even know what that means. I don't know what dedicating the seer stone on the altar of the Manti Temple means, but it clearly was something sacred to Wilford Woodruff.
Yeah.
And in fact, Wilford Woodruff is going to see some seer stone that Joseph will refer to as Urim and Thummim in December of 1841.
Yeah, and that's another important point that, so what we call the Urim and Thummim is taken back by Moroni, but they keep talking about
the Urim and Thummim.
So they are associating that name with other seer stones.
Yeah.
And I might add also that, for example, both Josiah Stoll, who is a firm Joseph Smith supporter, and Martin Harris, part of the reason they both believe Joseph is inspired and called of God is because they've seen him use his seer stone to tell them things or to see things that he couldn't otherwise see, but that they knew were accurate. For Martin Harris, he talks about finding a metal toothpick, literally in the haystack. He's got a metal toothpick in a haystack Joseph finds for him while looking in a hat. Josiah Stoll, he's able to describe Josiah's home and a tree where he's painted his hand on the trees. And these are people who are very pro-Joseph Smith, and they bring these incidents up to support Joseph being a seer.
Yeah, actually,
Josiah in court will do it.
Yeah, says it. Yeah. The early Latter-day Saints do not believe in the translation as being a miracle in spite of Joseph Smith using seer stones.
No, it's part of the miracle.
It is the miracle, right? Because look, anyone can dictate a book. And we could have all kinds of arguments about whether or not someone could dictate the Book of Mormon. I mean, I'd have that argument with you. But not anyone can make words appear on a stone, right? That is some kind of power that's beyond. And so, you know, when Joseph Knight gives his description of it, you know, that Joseph would place, you know, the Urim and Thummim in his hat, you know, to block out the light, and then, you know, would read off the translation to his scribe. The way he ends that conversation is, and so we see it was marvelous, which is really a 19th century word for meaning miraculous. When they say, we say marvelous today, we mean like, oh, wasn't that BYU game marvelous? Yeah, I mean, we
look a marvelous.
Yeah, exactly. We say it as like, that's like really great. But when they say marvelous, they mean miraculous. They mean it's impossible outside of a miracle. So these early accounts of translation, they embrace the fact that Joseph is using these sacred stones. So on the point of the term Urim and Thummim, I mean, as we go through early church history sources, we actually don't find that term being used, applied to even the stones found in the box of the plates until late 1832. Now someone might say, now, wait a minute. I know doctrine comes in section 17 when the witnesses are told what they're going to see, it says Urim and Thummim. It does. The problem is our earliest version of Doctrine Covenant Section 17 is from at best November, December of 1834. Yeah. And we already know that one of the things Joseph is doing is revising revelations like Doctrine Covenant Section 5 to include the term Urim and Thummim that wasn't there before. And so that's what I would suppose, because our earliest accounts from Joseph is he's using the term spectacles. Now what happens? Well, back to W.W. Phelps.
And he uses the term translators sometimes.
He uses
too,
translators,
right?
Interpreters, spectacles. But when we're talking about the earliest sources, we don't have that many early contemporary sources.
Yeah. I mean, when you say that the earliest is 1832, well, there aren't actually a ton of sources.
There's not. Yeah. I mean, there's a newspaper in Palmyra. Our earliest account of translation is from a quite antagonistic person in August of 1829. And you probably tuned into the podcast thinking, I'm not going to learn about what an anti-Mormon has to say about Joseph Smith in 1829, but you know what? Here you are. Yeah. The earliest antagonistic statements about Joseph, though, are actually, sometimes they're actually fairly accurate. Because before there's a church, before there's thousands of people joining in Kirtland, before there's a Book of Mormon, you know, in July of 1829, in August of 1829, there's hardly anyone who believes in Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
In
you've got a couple families.
Yeah, there's a couple families. We got some folks in Colesville, some folks in Fayette. In Palmyra, there's like just Martin Harris and, you know, sometimes, right?
I mean, and then the Rockwell family kind of,
yeah,
right?
Eventually, yeah, they're involved too. But there's just not a threat. Yeah. This is some kind of movement.
Yeah.
And so when this newspaper editor in Palmyra attacks Joseph, I mean, he basically just tells the story. He says he was visited three times in one night and he was told there were plates out behind his house. Because I think that person thinks, look, the story is crazy enough.
Yeah.
Right?
It just that'll turn people away by itself.
I mean,
itself.
If you think about it yourself, folks, I mean, if as you were walking out, you know, out of, you know, the grocery store today, if someone in the parking lot walked up to you and said, hey, I just saw an angel, your immediate reaction would be, in your mind at least, no, you didn't.
Yeah, it would be, ooh, I need to get moving.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're Latter-day Saints. We literally believe in the ministering of angels, and if someone told us they saw an angel, we'd be like, no, you didn't.
Yep.
And so, you know,
get into the car and lock the doors.
Exactly. Yep. In a world where people don't believe in the ministering of angels, I think early on people think, well, I mean, what do I really need to do here? He says he saw an angel, you know, that's obviously he's crazy because he says he saw an angel.
Yeah.
And in that account, you know, he says, you know, that Joseph said that he found spectacles. So even in 1829, that term spectacles before anything's published seems to be the way that Joseph is describing the stones that he found. Anyway, in late 1832, the church's newspaper talking about the translation of the gold plates says that these interpreters were called teraphim or Urim and Thummim. And it seems to be after that point that they start to use the term Urim and Thummim to describe not just the seer stones found in the box, but any seer stone. Brigham Young is very clear. April 17th in 1853, church minutes, that Joseph gives the stones found in the box back with the plates when he gives them back.
Yeah.
But he says that Joseph has other stones. Mm-hmm. And as we talked about, Wilford Woodruff, you know, one of his more exciting entries in his journal is Joseph shows him a seer stone in December of 1841.
And he talks about him using it with the Book of Abraham in that time period.
He does.
Not the 1835, but in the 1840s.
Yeah, he says that you know, God is through Joseph the seer, is, you know, allowing Joseph to translate records as old as Abraham and Adam. You know, at least that's what he says in that in exchange. But when he's shown it, Joseph calls it Urim and Thummim.
Yeah.
Even though it can't be the ones with the plates because those were already given back.
Yep.
And so, and you know, this is one of those things that I think everybody knows, they just don't know that they know it, that the term Urim and Thummim is a generic terminology for sacred stones. Why do they use it? Well, because the Bible uses the term Urim and Thummim. And what does it mean in the Bible? It's they're sacred stones that aid the high priest in receiving revelation. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of scholarly debate about how that would have happened.
Yeah.
But the point is, for Joseph's world, Urim and Thummim means sacred stones from God. So when someone's making fun of it, like Eber Howe, oh, he's just got rocks that he put in a hat. Right? By using the term Urim and Thummim, you are instantly making a claim. No, just like high priests in Israel use stones that were sacred to God to do sacred things, I'm using stones that were sacred to God to do sacred things. It's kind of trying to reclaim the narrative and place it in this religious light. You know, and of course, you know, Abraham's going to, you know, have the Urim and Thummim experience as well, you know, so this terminology becomes more generalized. And like I said, everyone knows this. They just don't know that they know it because, you know, what is the planet that God resides on? It's a giant Urim and Thummim. What is this world going to be like when in its glorified, sanctified, and immortal state? A giant Urim and Thummim. What is every member of the church going to get when they enter into the celestial kingdom? Their own Urim and Thummim.
Called a white stone Revelation,
but
right?
Exactly. But not the ones that were in the box with the plates, right? So Joseph's using this terminology more expansively. And I think that leads to confusion because there are some people who want to say, no, Joseph might've had seer stones, but he didn't use those to translate the Book of Mormon, even though the angel's description of the stones is that they're seer stones to translate the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, I mean, the Urim and Thummim or spectacles or whatever, they are seer stones. The other stones he has, and it seems like at least two, maybe more, who knows.
There's all kinds of speculation there.
Those are seer stones. They're all seer stones, right? And I hope that we can do a little bit of what Joseph was doing. As you said, I love that description of it. Like, okay, he's claiming this back into sacredness. You're making fun of these things. I'm telling you, these are real. This is our miracle. It's sacred. Let's claim it. I will always remember our friend that you talked about, written with earlier, Mike McKay, his phrase where when people hear seer stones, oh, that's weird. No, it's not weird. It's a miracle. And I remember him saying, I want my miracle back.
Yeah.
Let's rejoice in this miracle. Right. Let's be so grateful. Let's de-weirdize it, re-sacralize it maybe, and be grateful that God used whatever it was that Joseph was expecting, used to, and ready to open his mind up to receive revelation so that we could get the Book of Mormon and all those wonderful revelations that he received through it. Let's be so grateful for that miracle.
And, you know, for those who believe in the Book of Mormon as to be the Word of God, well, the Book of Mormon has ancient prophets who are translating records using stones.
Yeah.
So it would be weird to say, well, that's a miracle from God and that's sacred. But if Joseph does it, it's right out.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no possible way God would. And a good example of how a lot of our misgivings surrounding the translation really come from a lack of familiarity rather than from something being inherently wrong is the Liahona as an example. I mean, I would guess that anyone who's struggling with the idea of Joseph Smith using stones to translate the Book of Mormon has never struggled with the fact that a brass ball was found outside of Lehi's tent in the middle of nowhere and that words are written on it and that those words change pretty frequently and that the seer has the ability to read those words. In fact, we make that a point of faith. We say by small and simple means great things are brought to pass. None of us has had a faith crisis over words being miraculously etched into the Liahona and changed. But because we may not know about the the translation using the seer stones the same way. And because antagonists use it to mock and ridicule our religion, it places us in this almost defensive position. Do you want to talk about maybe some of the mechanics, at least as far as the...
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so again, the most important part of the translation of the Book of Mormon is for everyone listening to know that it's the Word of God.
Yeah.
That Joseph Smith is a prophet of God. And if you don't like thinking about the translation this way, look, it's not an article of faith. You need to know that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God.
Yeah. That we need to have a testimony of.
Yeah. How we get it, as long as you believe that God raised up Joseph Smith, the prophet and seer of this generation, to translate that book, that's what matters most.
Yeah.
So as I discuss what witnesses say about the translation, if you're like, well, I don't like that. You know what? Maybe the witness is wrong. Maybe, I mean, clearly I could be wrong. I mean, I'm not even a witness. I'm just repeating what they said.
Well, and most of them actually what they are describing, they didn't experience. So they have to be,
right.
They're secondhand, saying
this is what happened, but you don't know. Did Joseph tell them that's what happened?
Yeah.
Are they just guessing? There is a lot of consistency among the witnesses.
Yeah.
And in, you know, multiple independent attestations, right? So even sources that don't know about other sources will describe the translation in the same way, even over the course of many decades. And so for historians,
you have to take that pretty seriously.
You have to take it seriously, especially because you don't have sources on the other side. So someone who feels uncomfortable with the idea that Joseph Smith used the seer stones or placed them in a hat or something, they will often say, well, Joseph never says that he did that. Okay. So that's at least in some ways true, although there are some accounts that they're claiming they talked to Joseph. So, I mean, but those are still secondhand, but Joseph himself never says it. Okay. But then you're arguing from the position of the absence of evidence, right? Well, we do have a dozen pretty credible sources from actual witnesses and scribes of translation who are desperately trying to defend that the Book of Mormon is the Word of God, who are saying that this is how it was done. And so for a historian looking at it, you don't have a reason to say, well, Martin Harris is lying about that.
Yeah.
And so was Emma Smith. And so was Joseph Knight. And so it's a weird thing to do, to say all of these people are independently desperately trying to defend the Book of Mormon, but just decided to all come up with a lie that antagonists are using to attack the church. And instead of saying, no, it actually happened this way, to just lean into the lie. I mean,
and as you said, some of them don't know that the others have said it.
Yeah.
Right. So if this were a court of law and you get several witnesses who have the same story and they didn't have the chance to find out what the other person's story was, that's when you say, okay, we've got to accept that story.
There's multiple independent, I mean, with New Testament research, right? You go into the multiple independent attestation. I mean, if we are getting the same story or similar story from sources that couldn't have used each other to make their story, well, what does that tell you? It doesn't mean that everything in that story is true, although it is, but it doesn't have to mean that. But it certainly means that people are having independent conclusions about what happened.
Yeah, and there's got to be a core of that's accurate.
That at least they experienced something where they both came away saying, this is what happened. Yeah. So our sources, part of the reason I walk through what the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith history have to say is our sources. You know, if all we had was the scriptures, the conclusion we would come away with, as I said, would be first, that God uses stones in the translation of the Book of Mormon. That's what the angel says they're going to be done. The Book of Mormon itself says stones are used to translate. The second would be that the way that those stones are used is that they are interacted with by the seer. The seer is looking at them, at least That's how Mosiah uses his stones in order to translate.
Yeah.
Now, maybe there's other ways to do it, but the only evidence we have is that a seer uses them by looking at them. The third would be that there are multiple different translation devices. There's at the very least the two stones that are mentioned in Ether that are bound together, and there's the single stone that's mentioned in Alma, which is not bound together. So at the very least, you have to say
quite likely,
almost certainly, but
almost certainly that the one that Mosiah has is different than the one that
you, you would have to. I mean, again, you'd be arguing from the absence of evidence in the sense that it's hard to believe that Mosiah has the same stones that Ether had, but there's no discussion in the Book of Mormon about how he got those.
Yeah. Right?
Somehow he has them, and so
they're all surprised that. That Limhi's people found this place.
Exactly.
Right?
They don't know about it. So
is that the same place where we found these stones? No, they never say that.
Right. Is it possible that there's a portion of what Mormon, you know, when he's abridging, he's like, let's cut out the finding the seer stones part.
And
I mean, it's possible, but that shouldn't be the conclusion you readily come to. The conclusion that's more obvious is, well, there's multiple sacred stones that God uses with his seers. Mm-hmm. And that
because
that's an
by
easy
the way, at the same time, there's a high priest
that has
some stones back in the old world, right?
So right. And so it seems to be a way that God is interacting with his prophets.
Yeah.
So that third one, that there's at least two, I agree with you. There's actually more than two, but at the very least, you have to conclude. Ether talks about two stones bound together. Alma talks about a single stone.
Right. And we can be sure about the one that's in the old world at the same time, right? So that's at least three sets.
You're right. Yeah. If at the very least, there's multiple stones that are sacred that are being used by God's people. So those three things are pretty solid. So when I start to reconstruct, even in my own mind, how was the Book of Mormon translated? I should expect that there are stones, that the prophet is going to look at those stones, and that there's more than just one translation device. And the last thing you might conclude, you don't have to conclude it, but it certainly wouldn't be the most off the wall conclusion, is what does Alma 37 say? That stone Gazalim will shine in darkness unto light.
Mm-hmm. And that it's part of the Book of Mormon process.
Right. Yeah. That's part of how things are going to, and so it's not a slam dunk. I'm not saying this is, you know, this is not a Barry Bonds homer into the upper decks, but it at least shouldn't be stunning to us if the way those stones operated is that they shined in darkness. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the symbolism of that is beautiful, by the way.
Is.
I would love it to be that way, even if we had no evidence, just because of the symbolism of it.
Yeah. In fact, if you take that symbolism and you carry it forward to Doctrine and Covenants section 6, when Oliver Cowdery appears to have a little, you know, he's got a little bit of a hitch in his testimony. I don't know what's going on, but he's almost overwhelmed by the miracle that he's experiencing as he's translating with Joseph, to the point where he's starting to have some doubts. And the way that the Savior, the way that the Lord in this revelation to Joseph, the way that he comforts Oliver's mind, part of what is using that symbolism. I am the light that shineth in the darkness, right? The words you're writing are from me. I mean, I think they're using that both symbolic and literal explanation to say, the words that are coming on the stone, even from this very revelation that Joseph says is written from the stones, that's the Lord speaking. It's not Joseph. And then, of course, he goes on to tell Oliver all about things that Joseph couldn't possibly know.
Yeah.
And Oliver knew that Joseph couldn't possibly know. And that, I think, settles Oliver's mind. So.
And maybe I can take a break just for a second while you bring that up. This is the Scriptures Are Real podcast, right? We want people to be able to picture this in a real life setting. So as you're picturing what we're talking about, use of the stones, shining and light, let's just go through that all of this translation that we're talking about now, we're not talking about what was translated and then lost or stolen. I know we should not call it the lost.
Yeah, the stolen pages. Yeah. I want to eliminate the term lost pages.
That's right. Yeah. So the stolen 116 pages, all of that's happened before. So what we have, the vast majority of that is happening in Joseph and Emma's little home in Harmony. There's going to be some of it that happens in Fayette as well. But most of our story is happening in Harmony.
Yeah. So we don't know exactly how much of what they had already translated is retained, right? Because there's a reference in Doctrine and Covenants section 10 that, you know, to that which you have retained. So clearly Joseph didn't give every page to Martin Harris, but boy, he sure gave a lot to him. I mean, it's like, it is a lot. And, at least the way that the translation is described by these witnesses actually kind of falls in line with what we might assume coming from our scriptural study anyway. So what does Emma Smith say? Emma says that Joseph would, that he used two different devices in the translation, that he used the two stones that were bound together, found with the plates. And then after that, he used a small stone that was not exactly black, but was rather dark in color. Martin Harris,
matches well with the description of the stone that the first presidency still has.
We have a brown stone that's often called the brown stone that's in the possession of the first presidency. It's in the first presidency vault, and images of it were taken, about almost 9-10 years ago now, and
published in the
Ensign back when it was the Ensign magazine, and. So you can go see that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I believe the article is called Joseph the Seer, and you could go find that. It's written by Richard Turley.
Yeah. Just Google, you'll find it.
Yeah. Go to churchofjesuschrist.org and if you type in, Joseph the Seer, it'll be the first thing that comes up probably. And, in it, you shows that image of that seer stone. Martin Harris and others will also describe the mechanics of that translation. One thing that Emma is very clear about is that there was nothing between Joseph and Emma while he translated. Mm-hmm. Now, I know sometimes people think, well, no, there was a sheet in between them. That sheet story, it actually seems to primarily come from antagonists of the church. Mm. Early on, they do draw a sheet when they're copying characters off the plates. When Joseph first gets the plates, they have a sheet drawn, and they're Joseph's, you know, etching or rubbing characters off the plates, and then he's handing them around the sheet so that they can make copies of the characters that he's made. That's how you get copies of the characters in circulation. But while they're translating, our accounts are that it's Joseph and the scribe seated at the same table.
Yeah.
And Emma is not a witness of the gold plates. She knows of their physical reality.
Yeah.
She feels the side of them. She moves them from side to side.
She leaves them through the tablecloth she gave him that's wrapped, they're wrapped
but
in.
But she doesn't see them in the same way that the eight witnesses do. So if Emma hasn't ever seen the plates, but she's sitting next to Joseph while he's translating, well, it's going to be a difficult thing to have plates concealed if she's sitting next to him while he's translating.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes to the descriptions that Martin Harris gives as well, that Joseph would place the stone or stones into his hat, and that as he looked in at the stones, that the translation would appear on the stones. Yeah. In fact, it might be good to just share how Joseph Knight Sr. describes it. Joseph Knight Sr. Provides a good description of this. He says that Joseph would put the Urim and Thummim into his hat and darkened his eyes. A sentence would appear in bright Roman letters. Then he would tell the writer, and he would write it, and then it would go away. And the next sentence would come, and so on. And then I've always found this is actually, if you were to read this, it's quite hilarious, because he says, if it was not spelt right, that's S-P-E-L-T, and then right spelled the way like right aid is spelled, R-I-T-E, So you don't really know how Joseph Knight would know whether or not it was spelled right.
It's like although spelling wasn't as standardized at the time. There was more than one way to spell a lot of words.
It's true, but there was a dictionary, and that's not in there. Yeah. But if it was not spelt right, it would not go away until it was right. And so he describes this, you know, because it really is, I think, the hat is probably the thing that makes people feel the most uncomfortable, right? What do you mean? What do you mean he has that? Is it like a magic hat?
Is he not looking at the plates? I think most people picture him looking at the plates.
Right.
Whereas it's pretty clear most of the time he's not. I think 90% of the time, Joseph would not be able to point and say, this is what I am translating from.
Yeah. I mean, at least, again, do we have an account of every day of translation? We certainly don't. Yeah.
And in fact, the one who translates the most, Oliver Cowdery, actually tells us less than
he doesn't give us a lot of the mechanics of translation.
Less, yeah.
David Whitmer provides one of the most, you know, effusive descriptions of translation and explaining again why Joseph is using a hat. He says that Joseph would put the seer stone into a hat.
And before you read, let's just say David was a scribe sometimes.
So David was not that we know of
a scribe,
but it's in his home that the translation's taking place.
Yeah, so he says, I thought that sometimes he spelled Oliver off.
Not that we have in the manuscript.
I mean,
so David doesn't claim that, but yeah, so David is not a scribe. He is a witness the same way that Joseph Knight is.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's in his home. So we can just pick that back up.
Thank you.
David Whitmer is a witness of the translation. Much of it occurs in his home. Is it possible that he even scribed some of it? Maybe, but the standard argument is that he's watching it. He's witnessing it.
Okay.
And so he will be asked about it. Now, of course, someone might say, well, yeah, but didn't David Whitmer apostatize? Absolutely. David Whitmer apostatizes, and unlike all of the other witnesses, he refuses to come back.
Yeah. In fact, my understanding is when Oliver dies, he's there hoping to convince David to come back, but
he certainly dies there. I mean, they're brothers-in-law. I mean, Oliver's married to David's sister. And so when Oliver gets sick on his way, I mean, Oliver gets baptized in Iowa, goes out to meet the Saints, but the Saints have already gone, to Utah. Mm-hmm. And Orson Hyde rebaptizes Oliver Cowdery. Cowdery actually even has a plan to go to D.C. to try to advocate on behalf of the Saints because there's such animosity towards the Saints from the federal government. And on his way back, he's going to get ill. He's going to stay in Missouri with his family because that's where his brother-in-laws are and things like
his
that.
His father-in-law.
He has lots of family there in Missouri. And then he's not going to recover from that illness and he's going to pass away. But David Whitmer, even though he is always a critic of all of the various churches, he's a critic of our church. He's a critic of the reorganized church. He's a critic of the he tries to found his own church several times. It doesn't really work out, while he is someone who apostatized from the church, he doesn't apostatize from his testimony.
Yeah. No, he backs that up to his dying.
He is adamant that he saw an angel, that Joseph Smith was a prophet. Now, he's going to claim that Joseph eventually fell from his prophethood and became a sinner. But in fact, he's pretty adamant about it. I mean, late in his life, someone will publish in a newspaper in Missouri, oh, I talked to David Whitmer last week and he told me that he never really saw the angel David Whitmer's so incensed that he takes out an article in the newspaper himself saying, since this person, and he calls him by name, he's claiming that I said that I didn't really believe, that he may understand me now if he did not then, that I have never denied the testimony that has gone forth through the world in that book. I mean, David Whitmer is adamant about his seeing the plates and about the Book of Mormon being the Word of God.
Yeah.
So as I read his account, yes, someone might say, yeah, but David apostatized. Yeah, but that's not the point of what he's reading here. He's not reading to attack Joseph. He is trying to prove to you how this was really a miracle. Not,
no, he supports the divine nature of the translation of the Book of Mormon all the time.
He, in fact, if anything, he supports it even more after his apostasy, in the sense that, well, the Book of Mormon's the miracle, but Joseph's a flawed man. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like to him, the Book of Mormon's even greater witness of the Word of God, because I know Joseph and he's not very good at banking and you know, yeah. whatever the concerns are. But the Book of Mormon, it can't have come from Joseph. That I honestly get the sense from David that he leans even further in to his witness. Yeah. So anyway, what he says is, Joseph would put the seer stone into a hat and put his face into the hat, drawing it close around his face to exclude the light. And in the darkness, the spiritual light would shine. So both Joseph Knight, and then there's a Martin Harris quote I could read too, but Joseph Knight and David Whitmer are explaining why Joseph uses the hat. It's not a magic hat. It's not Frosty the Snowman's hat. Yeah. You don't put it on his head and he begins to dance around. It's a tool. In order to see what's appearing on the stone, he has to make it dark enough around the stone so we can see it.
Yeah, which happens with my phone and bright sunlight.
It's true. And
yeah.
even, you know, Elder Uchtdorf in a Facebook post made the exact same analogy. He said, you know, any of us who've been walking out on a beach on a bright day has covered part of their phone up to see what was on there. You could make the entire room dark, but that's not as effective for Oliver Cowdery to write.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So if you make the room dark, then the scribe can't see. If you make it just dark around the stone, well, now I can work at any hour.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a matter of making the room dark. And so that, you know, I know that makes people feel uncomfortable because, you know, you have all kinds of antagonists in the world that will, you know, mock and make fun of that. Oh, look at my, they'll make fun of it. Just like antagonists make fun of Christianity, just like they make fun of things that are sacred. But the fact that someone dresses up in temple clothes and walks around the conference center at general conference time does not make our temple rituals and covenants any less sacred.
Yeah.
The fact that someone mocks it should not make us say, well, that must not be true. We should take these fools who mock for what they are, but not allow them to affect our testimonies or our faith. So at least according to those accounts, Joseph is going to place the stone or stones into the hat. And apparently, at least the way witnesses understood it, is that words appeared on those stones. For David Whitmer, as he continues, he provides, again, this is more detailed than anyone else, so maybe he's not right on this. It's possible he's wrong. But he says, a piece of something resembling a parchment would appear, and on that appeared the writing. One character would appear, and under it was the interpretation in English. So at least David Whitmer's understanding is that part of the reason why Joseph wasn't looking directly at the plates is the character from the plates is actually appearing on the stone.
Yeah.
So the character appears and then the translation under. It's interesting the way you phrase it too makes it seem like each character is many words. The way he's describing it,
yeah.
A character is multiple words. Yeah. But anyway.
Now, and that may be even just a little misunderstanding. So if this is Reformed Egyptian, right?
Yeah.
So in Egyptian, you'll often get what we, you know, one glyph represents one to maybe five, typically one to three consonants, no vowels included.
Right.
So you could have one character, I mean, it's common, one character, one word, one character, one word, right? Like, so I look at this and it's three letters for us here. And I look at this and in English, that's going to be five or six letters, right? For one character. So it's possible that that's what's happening in the way Joseph Smith describes that, that it becomes a little bit multiplied for David Whitmer or something. That's kind of how I would guess it's happening. But in the end, I don't know. I'm just making it up.
It's tough to know, you know, what to do with a dead language, right?
So
it's hard to.
And it's a changed language from what anything we know. Yeah. And is it?
We need a Nephite Rosetta Stone.
That would be handy.
That would be very helpful.
I could make a living off that.
I'd be pretty excited to be a part of that dig, but. He says, Brother Joseph would read off the English to Oliver, who was his principal scribe, And then when it was written down and repeated to Brother Joseph to see if it was correct, then it would disappear and another character with the interpretation would appear. Thus, the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God and not by any power of man. And so you can tell here David Whitmer saying, yeah, words are appearing on a stone, and that's the miracle.
Yeah.
The miracle is this is beyond Joseph's ability. You have other people that make these statements. As I referenced, this early Palmyra newspaper editor, his...
And is that Obadiah Dogberry?
No, this is not. So,
okay.
So even before Obadiah Dogberry, okay. Obadiah Dogberry, which is Abner Cole.
Yeah.
Abner Cole is infamous in yeah. early church history because he tries to steal the text of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. And he's ready to fight Joseph.
He's ready to go to war with Joseph. But that event occurs probably in January of 1830. I mean, mm-hmm. it's hard to figure, but it's sometime around January that Joseph has this confrontation with Abner Cole.
Yeah.
But with the other newspaper editor in Palmyra that's not Egbert Grandin is a guy by the name of Jonathan Hadley. Mm. And Hadley is a political and economic opponent of Egbert Grandin. And Joseph and Martin approach Hadley to ask him to publish the book because Egbert Grandin at first says, no.
Yeah.
And not only says no, at least according to his brother-in-law, he attempts to get all of Martin Harris's friends to weigh in to stop Martin Harris from paying for the book. So Grandin's not just like a passive, I don't have time for you. He appears to be actively working against the publication.
Yeah.
So they go to the other publisher in town. The other newspaper editor is Jonathan Hadley. He runs a newspaper called the Palmyra Freeman. And in that newspaper... they attack one another constantly. Grandin and Hadley hate one another. One's an anti-Masonic paper, and this is the height of anti-Masonry in the United States at the time. One's an anti-Masonic paper. Grandin's paper is pro-Masonic, and so I know it's going to be hard for the listeners to believe that there was a time in American politics when people attacked each other vociferously and made all kinds of personal insults. But in the 19th century, it happened. In the 19th century, people would attack each other personally over politics. It's good time.
I'm glad we stopped doing
it. It's good that we've moved away. We've become more civilized. But so Hadley apparently, for whatever reason, says that he can't publish it. But he must have sent them to the master that he apprenticed under. Mm-hmm. Because instead of looking for another printer, Joseph and Martin travel all the way to Rochester, which is a day's journey away. I mean, it's not too bad for us when we go to Rochester today. Yeah. But Palmyra to Rochester is not next door.
No.
And you're going through many towns with many printing presses. Why are they going to Rochester? Well, Thurlow Weed, who is the master that Jonathan Hadley apprenticed under, they go to see him. We don't know exactly why Thurlow Weed told them no. Thurlow Weed provides multiple different accounts of that, and they change over time. And he's always giving them, Thurlow Weed's a politician. He actually is one of the people who is credited with the rise of William Henry Seward as the great Whig and then Republican politician in the 19th century. But one of his accounts is actually my most favorite, his latest account, his last account of their meeting. I like really wish is true. I don't know that it is. It probably isn't. I don't know. But he at least says that when Joseph and Martin come to meet with him, that to prove to him that the translation was true, Joseph pulled the stone out right then and put it into his hat and began doing some translation to show it to him. I don't know that that's the case because
that would be cool.
It would be amazing. It'd be a great story. But Thurlow Weed also is a politician. And so he's not always being strictly honest. His earliest account of why he turns down the Book of Mormon is he says that we weren't in the business of publishing books. That's probably the most likely thing. And then every time anti-Mormonism flares up in the country, he weighs in again with like, I told Martin Harris that this is a vile imposture. I mean, he wants to make himself look really good as the defender of Christianity against Mormonism. But at any rate, Thurlow Weed tells him no. And so they find another printer in Rochester who says that they will do it. So this is Elihu Marshall. So now they come back down to Palmyra and their conversation with Grandin's very different. Grandin could publish it. He just wouldn't publish it.
Right.
So he has the ability to publish books. He won't do it.
Yeah.
And they come back and you can only assume we don't have a record of this.
Yeah.
But Grandin, at least according to his brother-in-law, relents. And you know, they're probably saying, look, we're going to publish this either way. Well, if we'll publish it in Rochester, if we have to, we don't want to, because, you know, we'd have to go board up in Rochester for some crazy reason. They're worried people will try to steal pages of the translation. So they don't want to just give it all over, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so they have a bad experience already. And Grandin relents and says, fine, I'll publish it.
Yeah. As long as you give me a huge amount of money down.
A huge amount of money. Yeah. In fact, you know, Mike and I tried to estimate, and it's likely that Grandin had somewhere in the neighborhood of like a 30 to even 40% markup on what it really would have cost.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, it's a huge amount more than would be typical for that.
And they have to pay it up front.
Yeah.
And John Gilbert, the typesetter of the Book of Mormon who works in Grandin's print shop, says that Grandin wouldn't even buy the type for it until he was paid up front.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, so I know that's a little bit of an aside, but I tell that story to say when Jonathan Hadley finds out in July and August that it's not his buddy in Rochester that's going to be getting the $3,000. And to give you an idea how much $3,000 is back then, the average American makes somewhere around $250 a year, maybe $300 depending on your estimate and where you live. So Joseph Smith owns a 13.5-acre farm in Pennsylvania that he purchases. I say purchase. I mean, he owns it the same way I own my house.
Right.
And that is, I don't. You know, I'm making payments on it. And if I ever want to find out who really owns my house, I just need to miss one payment. And they'll be more than willing to let me know who actually owns my house. And it's not me.
Yeah.
But he buys a 13.5-acre farm with an existing house on it, other outbuildings on it, some of it improved, some of it fenced, for $200. That means the cost of printing the Book of Mormon is 15 times Joseph Smith's entire net worth if he owned his whole farm, which he doesn't own his farm.
Yeah.
So this is an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
And when Jonathan Hadley, the publisher of the Palmyra Freeman, finds out that it's not his buddy that's getting it, but his crosstown rival that he does nothing but hate is now getting this huge infusion of cash into his paper and into his printing shop. He unloads on our earliest comprehensive antagonistic article that's published. And our earliest, I mean, so it, even Grandin himself, before he agrees to bring the Book of Mormon, he mocks the Book of Mormon. He's like, oh, it's pretended that this book is going to be put to press in this village. It's like, well, pretended. I mean, you're kind of the one doing it. I mean, it's not a very smart thing to say. Like, I don't know if we'll actually deliver on this order, because that was before he made the agreement.
Right.
So this is a cool document because a lot of our later documents are just borrowing from other publications.
Yeah.
Right. So someone publishes
the same thing circulated again.
Yeah.
And
if someone published
again
in 1833, I'll tell you what really happened with the plates, but they're just quoting someone else. This is the earliest published account of translation in or out of the church. And so I thought maybe I'd share a little bit of that with your listeners. So he titles it Golden Bible. And the date on this is August 11th, 1829. So how early is this? This is before the first words of the Book of Mormon have been typeset. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they haven't even started typesetting the Book of Mormon yet. There are no other newspaper articles describing translation, the finding of the plates. None of that exists yet. This is the first one. There are like I said, there are a couple of antagonistic articles that say, oh, you know, Joe Smith claims he found a gold plate, but nothing that relates to the translation. And this is how he says, so this is going to come, there's going to be a lot of sarcasm here, so you got to bear with me. He's actually a very good writer. He's just very antagonistic. The greatest piece of superstition that has ever come within the sphere of our knowledge is one that has for some time past and still occupies the attention of a few superstitious and bigoted individuals in this quarter. Now, bigoted back then meant uneducated. I mean, it kind of means that now, but it especially meant back then, if you were bigoted, it meant you were stupid,
yeah,
essentially. But it is generally known and spoken of as the Golden Bible. Its proselytes give the following account of it. In the fall of 1827, a person by the name of Joseph Smith of Manchester, Ontario County, reported that he'd been visited in a dream by the Spirit of the Almighty and informed that in a certain hill in that town was deposited this golden Bible containing an ancient record of divine nature and origin. After having been thrice thus visited, and then he starts putting these caveats in here so that you know he doesn't believe this. He says, after having been thrice thus visited, as he states, you know, so Joseph's yeah, the yeah. one saying this. Obviously, this didn't happen. after having thrice been visited, as he states, he proceeded to the spot, and the Bible was found together with a huge pair of spectacles. So notice, the earliest description of these stones that's ever published in that newspaper, again, they're claiming this is information they got from Joseph, is exactly the same way Joseph describes it in his own writing in 1832 when he describes what's found with the plate. So that, for a historian, you would say, what's more likely, that this antagonist just made up the term spectacles and that Joseph 3 years later said, you know what? I like the way that guy mocked me. I'm going to use the word spectacles, or that really is the word Joseph's using to describe it.
It's
clearly more likely that the terminology being used is spectacles. At any rate, he had been directed, however, to let no mortal being examine them under no less penalty than instant death. They were therefore nicely wrapped up and excluded from the vulgar gaze of poor wicked mortals. He's laying it on pretty thick here, right? Yeah. But he says, it was said that the leaves of the Bible were plates of gold, about 8 inches long, 6 inches wide, and 1/8 of an inch thick. Now, we get lots of people who describe the dimensions of the plates. Only Joseph describes the dimensions like that, where that's exactly the descriptions that Joseph gives in Joseph Smith history. So again, for a historian, the evidence that Hadley has real information,
right,
a real conversation with, at the very least, Martin Harris, if not, he says, he keeps saying Joseph Smith said, but yeah. I mean,
well, and Joseph visited him to try and get him.
Exactly. And Joseph Smith lives there in Palmyra. It's not like, you know, it's not the hardest thing to believe that this guy's getting his information from Joseph, but even if he isn't, let's say he's just getting it from Martin Harris. Either way, now, it'd be kind of weird since the dimensions of the plates Martin Harris gives are actually different than those. But regardless, he has some real information. I mean, he knows that he's visited three times. He knows the dimensions of the plates. He knows that they're using that term spectacles. And what he says following that is, by placing the spectacles into a hat and looking into it, Smith could, and then he has in parentheses, he said so at least, interpret these characters. And so for a historian, what do you have? You have the very earliest account of translation that exists that clearly has some conversation with Joseph or some other, and there's not very many, believers that say that the way Joseph translated was by placing these stones into a hat. You have his wife saying the way that Joseph translated was by placing stones into a hat. You have Martin Harris, who's one of the scribes, saying that he placed stones into a hat. You have David Whitmer saying that he placed stones into a hat. Joseph Knight saying that he placed stones into a hat. Even Orson Hyde, although not a witness, when Orson Hyde writes his German tract trying to convince people to join the church when he's in Europe, even he says that these stones had to be placed somewhere dark in order for them to be seen. So it's again, you can see why historians come to the conclusion that they do.
Yeah.
I don't have a reason to say that these multiple independent attestations, the earliest account and antagonistic is the same as the latest account, David Whitmer and Pro.
The consistency just by itself would speak to this, but the consistency over a long period of time with different kinds of witnesses is pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, and to counterfactually look at it, I mean, to argue that Emma is not telling the truth about it, that Martin Harris isn't telling the truth about it, that David Whitmer isn't, that they're all not doing that, well, what would the motivation for that be? Because the mockery that Joseph is placing the stones in a hat has already begun in 1829. Yeah. It's already begun.
Yeah.
And it goes into overdrive when Eber Howe publishes The Mormonism Unveiled in 1834. The mockery of, he places these stones in a hat, la, 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 making fun of it. So why then, when she's trying to defend her husband, would Emma, in her later interviews and in a letter that she writes, why would she, instead of saying how it really happened, quote what antagonists are saying about how it happened?
Yeah.
It doesn't really make sense.
So unlikely she would make that up.
Right. Why would, when Martin Harris is defending the Book of Mormon, instead of saying how it really happened, say, well, you know how Eber Howe mocked it and made fun of it? Yeah, that we'll just go with that. I won't tell you how it really happened. So that's the reason why. So for people who don't want to believe that narrative, they will say, well, Joseph himself doesn't ever say it. And that is a fair point. And part of the reason why we shouldn't get too wrapped up in whether it happened this way or this way. But Joseph not explaining how it happened does not, for a historian, trump how everyone else said that it happened.
Yeah.
Is it possible that it happened some other way? Of course.
And is it possible that there are a couple of different ways that this happens?
We're talking about a miracle. Yeah. So, sometimes people will say, well, yeah, but if Joseph had his, if he had his, you know, the stones in a hat, well, then why would he even need the gold plates? I mean, if the question is, could God have given the text of the Book of Mormon to Joseph Smith without Joseph having the plates? Since I said, could God, we already know what the answer is.
That's right.
Clearly, God could have, but that's not how God chose to have Joseph translate the gold plates.
Wonderful.
And I feel like Joseph translates in multiple different ways. I mean,
I agree.
Doctrine and Covenants section 7 is a great example of this. I mean, maybe you have some insight from some digs that I don't know about, but as far as I know, you know, Joseph didn't take a quick trip to the Holy Land and find the parchment that John hit up.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, apparently, whatever John actually wrote on that parchment, God is giving the entirety of that to Joseph by the means of the seer stones in the means of his translation.
I actually think not even the entirety. It seems like he gives him just a little, the entirety of what we have.
Right, the entirety of what we have.
That just seems to be just a pretty small thing. But
Joseph doesn't have a parchment in front of him.
He doesn't need it, right?
Yeah.
And same thing with translating the Bible. He's sitting there with an English copy of the Bible and giving us stuff that's not in that copy.
Right. The book of
God
Moses,
can do this all sorts of ways.
I mean, I know that you're more the Pearl of Great Price expert, but I have to say, from my own personal testimony, if you haven't read the Book of Moses lately, go read it.
Mm-hmm.
If you were if you weren't a Latter-day Saint, if you were just a scholar who is stumbling and bumbling your way along and decided you were going to look into Mormon history, and someone handed you Moses, and there was no date on it, and they asked you, when did Joseph Smith produce this? You would say late 1843, early 1844.
Yeah.
It is so far beyond Joseph's knowledge and Joseph's understanding and Joseph's revelations.
And his ability to speak and write.
It is. This is very personal. So I'm not indicting anyone. I don't feel like we value the Book of Moses as proof that Joseph is a prophet as much as we should.
Yeah.
It is absolutely breathtaking.
Yes.
When you read Joseph's letters that he's writing at the time and then read Moses, you come away going, I don't know what's going on, but I know Joseph didn't write this.
Yeah,
I know that this person could not have done this. Well, again, the book of Moses, miraculous. As far as we know, Joseph doesn't have another scroll of the Hebrew Bible there in front of him. And it's revelatory. In fact, the way it's introduced in the book of Book of Commandments and Revelations is it's the revelation given to Moses, is what it's called.
Yeah.
So I understand why people would say, well, yeah, but I don't think that that's the way that it happened. And everyone's entitled to their opinion. But so that people understand why scholars conclude what they do it because of the overwhelming weight of witnesses. Now, for a long time, people said, yeah, but Oliver Cowdery never mentioned the hat. About 15 years ago, a non-Latter-day Saint scholar working with Shaker documents did find an Oliver Cowdery reference to him, to Joseph translating with a hat. Now, it's not very clear. And in fact, it's different than our other accounts of translation. Oliver Cowdery is sent on his mission. It's often called the mission to the Lamanites.
Yeah.
As a result of the Doctrine and Covenants section 28, revelation, that was the whole Hiram Page Searstone. He's called to go on that mission. And of course, famously, they stop and they preach in the Kirtland and Painesville area. Sidney Rigdon's converted. Hundreds of people join the church there. It becomes the new locale of the church. But they continue on their mission. And on their way through Ohio, they stop at another Shaker village. And apparently Oliver Cowdery preaches. And one of the Shaker elders writes very negatively in his journal about Oliver Cowdery preaching there. And he says that Joseph employed a hat, that Oliver Cowdery claimed that Joseph Smith used a hat in the translation. Now, again, is that definitive? No, it's not definitive. But when someone says there's no Oliver Cowdery source, well, there is one. I mean, it is contemporary. It's someone writing at the time. Are they understanding it right? Well, maybe not. Are they maybe copying something? Of course they could be. But again, the fact that there's a hat involved in the translation is already what the other witnesses are saying.
Right.
And, you know, our church manuals have all incorporated this. Yeah. This is how it's described in our church manuals. When President Nelson gave his interview a couple of years ago, he says the way Joseph translated was by placing stones into this hat. So if you feel uncomfortable about it, you know that President Nelson is not only obviously approving the curriculum that says that, even he is referring to it that way.
And yeah, he's comfortable with it.
He seems to be very comfortable with it. I mean, there's not a hat on the table in Harmony with the recreated Harmony site.
Yeah.
There's not a hat there by accident. It's not like the missionaries serving there, like, you know what, let's go put a hat on that table and see if anyone notices. So I think, and of course, the Gospel Topics essays, the church has produced to help provide some of these sources. So if your listeners are wondering, well, I want to know where some of those sources are, how I might find them. If you go to the church history tab on your gospel library and look up the Gospel Topics essays, there's one on the translation of the Book of Mormon that will have these sources. Obviously, there's the Ensign article that we talked about. There's other sources, other ways of coming to that conclusion. But for historians, faithful historians who absolutely believe the Book of Mormon is the Word of God and absolutely believe that Joseph Smith is the prophet and seer, it's the conclusion that it's arrived at because of the overwhelming weight of the sources.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, we better wrap up.
Okay.
But I am so grateful you'd explore this with us. I love the Book of Mormon, and so I love anything I learn about the translation of the Book of Mormon. I wish we knew more. I personally think that Joseph probably struggled to, I don't know about you, but when I have intense personal or revelatory experiences, I have a hard time understanding them, much less describing them. And my guess is that for Joseph, it was such an amazing, miraculous thing, he really just couldn't talk about it. But I'm grateful for the information we do have, and I'm grateful to know it was by the gift and power of God. Yeah. And I want to thank you for helping us explore that a little bit.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And you just add my testimony. I mean, the Book of Mormon stands as the great witness that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. I mean, obviously it brings us closer to Christ. I mean, that it is the second testament of Jesus. And for me personally, I mean, it matters a lot, because the reason why I am certain that my Savior lives, the reason why I came to my testimony, is not the way that a lot of people come to it. I mean, a lot of people already have a testimony, and then they learn about Joseph and that adds to their testimony. For me, I know that Jesus Christ is my Savior because I know that Joseph Smith saw him. And that allowed me to branch out and to gain testimonies of other things. But Joseph's witness of the Savior, the Book of Mormon witnessing the Savior through Joseph Smith, is why I know my Savior lives. And so I hope we can treat it with that preciousness that it is.
Thank you. Thank you. And we'll ask our audience to join us. We're going to have two episodes this week. This is kind of a bonus material, but it'll be our lead bonus material. But we also are going to talk about Section 5 with Richard Bushman. And he's as good a historian as we find.
Well, so. I'm going to suffer greatly by comparison. everyone's going to be like, you need to bring Richard Bushman back.
No, it's not true. But he is, in some ways, the dean of historians for LDS historians. And so we'd encourage you to tune in for that and share something you learned from this with your friends. And again, thank you, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.